Hello there, our dear listeners, and welcome to For the Love of Plants. Unfortunately, this month we've all been plagued with too much to do and so little time, as is common just as the season's kicking off. So we've not been able to find time to sit down together and have a chinwag as usual at the end of May. We have, however, managed to put something together. So you aren't left high and dry waiting for planty goodness from our monthly episode. So without further ado, Gaia, take it away.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Gardening by the Month segment of the podcast. Ta-da! With me, Gaia. It's a pleasure to be here. I actually need to open up this segment by firstly making an apology. Actually, I've been so wrapped up with work and college and Chelsea as well that I neglected to tell you about No Mo May. I can't believe it. So last month I told people to mow their lawns once, twice a week, increasing as the season goes on. And despite the fact that I care about the environment, I like to think I know a few things about how to care for the environment in terms of gardening and horticulture, and yet I still forgot. So I would firstly like to apologise for that, and now I would like to tell you about No Mo May so that you can either go for it in June, or perhaps you want to go for it next year, in which case at least we've definitely got the information across for next year, and I will be sure to remind you in the May podcast of 2024. Ooh. So I shall set a reminder. So what is No Mo May? Well, I think it's kind of obvious in case you haven't worked it out. No Mo May is just how it sounds. It's where you choose not to mow either part or the entirety of your lawn for the whole of May, which to some people sounds like an eternity. When they start to see it get all raggly, they want to do something about it, but no. So let's talk about the benefits of No Mo May and why this is something that we should really catch on to and give a go. So by choosing not to mow your lawn, you are allowing grass and other plants to grow, which has a number of benefits. It provides a habitat for insects, which are important for pollination and biodiversity, as well as giving them a nectar base for them to draw from. Additionally, a wild lawn can be aesthetically pleasing, with lots of wild flowers to get identifying and enjoying, and it can even save you time and money by eliminating the need for lawn care. If you're a bit of an insect head, like Charlotte on the podcast, then you might enjoy what she likes to do, which is sit back and just watch the lawn to see what comes out. You might see some interesting butterflies, you might see some interesting species of bees, you might see all sorts of things. And you can sit there and you can take some pictures and you can go and have a little look at what the identities are. And then also you can contribute to citizen science projects. So you can actually report what kind of flowers are popping up, what kind of insects are you seeing, and contribute to a wider ecological study. That's brilliant. And then we come to the end of the month where you may choose to mow it. But I ask you, please, if you are going to mow the entirety of it, please do it gradually. Don't just go ahead and mow the whole thing. Because if you imagine, if you popped out to the shops one day and you came back and your home was absolutely crumbled to the ground, completely disappeared, well, you'd be a bit sodded, is the technical term. So at least if you only cut down a little bit, well, then you can move into the annex next door and you'll be okay. So just bear that in mind if you just do decide to mow at the end of May. For more information about No Mo May, go to www.plantlife.org.uk/campaigns/No Mo May.
Hello, and Welcome to this month's houseplant segment with me, Charlotte. So today I am focusing on how to repot a houseplant which has outgrown its pot. So firstly, we need to establish how can we tell when it's time to repot a houseplant. So I have a few key indicators here, and I'm going to use my Philodendron soderoi as an example, which I have in front of me. So the first indicator is that your plant is top heavy. And what I mean by that is, well, for example, with my Philodendron soderoi, I've knocked it over quite a few times now. That's because it's in a 9cm pot and it's about 30cm tall. It's a lovely vining plant and it's quite heavy on the top now. So maybe I ought to repot it. The second indicator is that you are experiencing that you are having to water constantly to stop your plant from wilting. And this is because there's not actually enough space for the water in the potting medium, and the roots are taking up all of the water really, really quickly, which is probably going to stress your plant out. And I'm experiencing that with my Philodendron too, because again, it's root bound, it needs a repot. The third indicator is that when you take your plant out of the pot and you check the roots, you can ask yourself three things. And if you say yes to these three things, it means it probably needs to be repotted. So when you check the roots, firstly, are they winding around the base of the pot? Does the root system look compacted? So does it look like there are just lots of roots in there and you can see a lot of them? Is the root system holding the soil together? So when you take the plant out of the pot, if the soil just completely falls away and you're just left with the roots, then it probably doesn't need repotting, and actually repotting is probably going to be detrimental to the plant. But if you take the plant out of the pot and the roots are so compacted that actually they're holding the soil together, then that's a really, really good sign that it's definitely time to repot. The final indicator that I often experience is that if the plant is in desperate need of a repot, sometimes you might experience the bottom leaves starting to yellow. It's really important though with this final tip that you rule out any other issues such as root rot, underwatering, or nutrient deficiencies. So now we know when to repot our plants. But we are still left with two main questions, which are: what potting medium should I use, and what size pot should I use? Well, for potting medium, I can't give you the answer to that because each plant is so unique and individual. So what I really recommend you do is you try to identify your plant, and you can do this by going on a Facebook houseplant group, on Reddit, on Instagram, or going straight to a professional. And once you've found out your species or your cultivar, you can do an internet search for what potting mix your specific plant needs, and you should get all of the answers that you want. For pot size, some plants are more tolerant of being repotted into a bigger pot, but a really good rule of thumb that I found is to go for a pot about an inch bigger in diameter. So, for example, with my Philodendron soderoi here, I'm going to go from a 9cm pot up to a 13cm pot. When you're repotting, I have a really brilliant trick that I've learned over the years. So, for me, I'm filling my 13cm pot with 1/5 of the potting medium, and then I'm taking the Philodendron soderoi out of its 9cm pot, and I'm putting the 9cm pot on top of the potting medium that I just put into the 13cm pot. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to fill around the edges of the 9cm pot, and then I'm going to take the 9cm pot out, and what I'm left with is a really nice perfectly shaped hole for the Philodendron soderoi to be potted into. So this tip really works for me, but as long as you get the plant in the pot, that is the main thing. One thing that you really, really want to look out for when you're repotting your plant is that you want your plant to be planted at the same level as it was previously planted. too high up and your plant's going to dry out, and too low down and your plant is going to rot. So that is the basics of repotting your plants. After this, you need to make sure that you water your plant in. Always make sure that your plant's pretty moist when you're carrying out this process, because it just protects the roots. So once you've watered your plant in, you just put it back where you found it, and there you have it. A nice plant, looking healthy, looking happy, in a nice big pot.
Now, on to the plants for this month. So I've decided to make things a little bit more interesting this month. In case you haven't heard about Charlotte and me going on about it loads already, we had a garden at Chelsea with Sparshot College, and we had an absolutely amazing time, I'd just like to say. And the whole thing was centered around helping people to reimagine their connection with plants and to understand what uses lie behind their aesthetic features. And so every single plant that I have listed this month that's going to be in flower, that's going to be showing itself off to you, I have also attached a single use as well. And it's best to note as well that these are not the only uses that I am saying. I'm just restricting it to one, and I hope you learn something new and I hope you find it interesting. The first plant on our list is lupins. These can be used as a soybean substitute. Next up, we've got verbascum. This can be used to treat skin disorders. There's alchemilla, which can be used to treat menstrual cramps and has historically been used to do so. We've got geums, which provide a lovely edible flower for use in salads. We've got nepeta, also known as catmint. And regardless of the uses surrounding cats, you can also use the leaves as a herbal tea to aid sleep and relieve congestion. Bearded irises are often used as a botanic ingredient in gins such as Bombay Sapphire. Honeysuckle helps headaches and treatment for constipation. Mock orange or Philadelphus can be used to create soap and perfumes. We've got yarrow, which is Achillea millefolium, which speeds up the healing of wounds. Peony helps blood circulation by acting as an anticoagulant. Alstroemeria, this is a bit of a cop-out. Alstroemeria is actually poisonous, but it can be used as a delightful cut flower. Dianthus, which can be used to treat urinary tract infections. And lastly, roses. Roses coming out everywhere. Rose water itself can be used to care and nourish your skin. Now remember, before using these plants for any of these uses, make sure that you check the specific species that you are looking at. Make sure it's good to consume. Clean the plant material thoroughly. Don't harvest everything. Leave some for the insects and the wildlife, please. But above all, explore everything and make the most of it. Now onto the tasks this month. We're going to want to water regularly, especially fruits like tomatoes, to prevent blossom end rot and cracking. Also, as things start to really heat up, we want to make sure that all of our shrubs are mulched, and this will prevent moisture from evaporating from the soil surface and making sure that we provide consistent moisture for our plants. We will also need to stay on top of weeding, and this is to help plants from having to compete with these weeds for nutrients and moisture. It's also time to prune your mature deciduous shrubs such as Deutzia, Colquevitzia, Philadelphus, the mock orange I mentioned earlier, and Weigela. As well as this, it's also time to deadhead. Make sure to take a special care. You want to cut down to the next set of buds, and hopefully this should mean that you get a longer flowering season. Speaking of flowers also, you'll want to remove suckers from roses. These will come up from the ground from the rootstock and will be of the variety of the rootstock, which is of course not your intended flower. So in order to get rid of these, you can either snip them, which is a slightly lazy method, or you can slightly dig around and snip close to the rootstock, and this will prevent them from coming up more regularly. Lastly, it's also time to tidy up your bulbs and get dividing for a especially momentous display next year.
So I have to take a minute to just revel in Gaia and Charlotte's fantastic garden at Chelsea Flower Show. They helped create a garden for Sparshall College at the show. It was called Rustic Recipes Reimagined. Now, I was privileged enough to get to see this unique garden, and I got to meet Charlotte too, which was awesome. But the garden was something else, and in the end, it rightly so won a gold medal. So hats off to Charlotte and Gaia. An amazing achievement. I'm mega proud of you both. Just keep doing what you're doing. And also, I'm majorly relieved that the Just Stop Oil protesters didn't decide to target your garden. So outside of their garden, my two favourite show gardens from Chelsea were A Letter from a Million Years Past. This was a garden designed by Zhihe Huang. It was like getting teleported to a different continent within a millisecond. The garden was a memorial to one of the last primeval forests in Joseon, Korea, where medicinal herbs, specialty plants, and rare endangered alpine plants go. There was a historically traditional built medicinal herb drying tower within the garden, which alongside the rough wild landscape really gave you a sense of the differing culture in Korea and how the landscapes might feel. When I was looking at the garden, they also had some traditional Korean musicians playing those incredibly atmospheric string instruments, which I later found out were called kaegeon, which added further to the emotional vibe that the garden was portraying. Unsurprisingly, that garden won a gold. My second favourite show garden was the Royal Entomological Society garden. For me, the colossal, rusty, metallic structure made up of hexagons and stained glass windows completely blew me away. It was such a feat of design engineering, and somehow it worked and synced well with the perfect for pollinated plants surrounding it. The sun shined down through the stained glass on the visitor area below, creating a completely unique, segregated environment. And unlike the Korean Million Years Past garden, I kind of felt like I'd been transported a million years into the future with this garden, and it won a silver gilt medal. But of course, in my opinion, the most impressive garden was Charlotte and Gaia's. Some notable news headlines for our listeners. The RHS has released a new strategy to 2030 approach to gardening and how to incorporate it into people's lives more. Because, well, I agree with the RHS. In my opinion, we're all gardeners at heart. It doesn't matter how much the materialistic societal jargon distracts us. The truth is, we all like to see things grow. It is an evolutionary instinct for us to enjoy being outdoors connected to nature. The RHS are looking to branch out, excuse the pun, to different demographics and make gardening more accessible and enjoyable. From infancy all the way through to late adulthood, better known as being old. So check it out on the RHS website and see if you can get anything from it. A species of endangered orchid has flowered in the UK for the first time. Dendrophyllax lindenii, or the Florida ghost orchid, has blossomed at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew. It was brought into the UK from Chicago 2 weeks ago, all in aid of conservation efforts. Dendrophyllax lindenii is on the IUCN red list of threatened species. I don't think we've done an episode of For the Love of Plants and not referenced the IUCN red list. But anyway, there are 1,500 ghost orchid plants left in South Florida and 500 in Cuba. So it's been brought over to the UK to aid in conservation efforts. If you want to see this ghost orchid, then you can visit the Princess of Wales Conservatory at Kew. According to the Royal Botanic Gardens of Edinburgh, sex in the country is better for British bluebells than we first thought. New research indicates the genetic threat to native bluebells from Spanish bluebells is relatively low and has generally been aided by well-intentioned humans bulking up plant populations in private gardens. Over the years, there has been much chatter about non-native bluebells or Spanish bluebells interbreeding with our native bluebells, which hypothetically could intermix the gene pool to such an extent that our pure British bluebells become extinct. A massive survey, however, of 56 populations of bluebells was taken across Britain, and it found that only 16% were non-native hybrids. According to Professor Peter Hollingsworth, with lack of human intervention, hybridization is limited in native bluebell habitats such as woodlands and rural hedgerows. Even in residential areas bordering natural bluebell populations, hybrids rarely spread out of the contact zone. Far from worrying about extinction by hybridization of Hyacinthides nonscripta in the UK, we should be comforted by the fact that, left to our own devices, our native bluebells have massive advantages over non-natives. According to the University of Sheffield, fungi stores a third of carbon fossil fuel emissions and could be essential to reaching net zero. Mycorrhizal fungi are responsible for holding up to 36% of yearly global fossil fuel emissions below ground, more than China emits each year. The fungi make up a vast underground network all over the planet, underneath grasslands and forests, as well as roads, gardens and houses on every continent on Earth, more commonly known as the World Wide Web. It is not only crucial to storing carbon and keeping the planet cooler, but also essential to global biodiversity. Researchers are now calling for fungi to be considered more heavily in conservation and biodiversity policies, and are investigating whether we can increase how much carbon the soil underneath us can hold.
Now on for events. We've got the Garden Show at Stansted Park from the 9th to the 11th of June. Special Rose Week at Pashley Manor Garden in East Sussex on the 16th to the 24th. RHS Botanical Art and Photography Show from the 16th of June to the 9th of July. We've got the BBC Gardeners World Live in NEC Birmingham from the 15th to the 18th of June. And lastly, the Blenheim Palace Flower Show from the 23rd to the 25th. As a pre-warning as well, we've got the RHS show Tatton Park from the 19th to the 23rd of July, and tickets are still available. Thank you for joining me on this June edition of the Gardening by the Month segment. With me, Gaia, it's been an absolute pleasure. Now back to the podcast.
Thanks so much to Gaia and Charlotte for contributing to this episode. And thanks for listening to this episode, even though it's been somewhat unconventional. I leave you with this haughty-thoughty. Everybody loves the showy, colourful flowers of hydrangeas, but did you know that the mop-like flowerhead is actually made up of two different types of flowers? The smaller, central flowers are fertile flowers, and the larger, showy flowers on the outside are infertile flowers, purely there for show. This is obvious in the case of Hydrangea petiolaris. Generally speaking, cultivated varieties have been bred over the years to have more of the showy infertile flowers, giving those classic pom-poms of colour. And in the wild, hydrangeas mainly have the smaller flowerheads for reproduction purposes. So now you know. Wishing all our listeners a cracking June. The garden I work in, Colebrook House, is open to the public this weekend. So if you happen to be wandering around the Cotswolds and want to see something special, come down to Colebrook House in Blockley for the Blockley National Garden Scheme and prepare to be horticulturally blown away by one of the most fantastic gardens in the Cotswolds. Okay, that's it. I'm done. Bye, guys.
Bye.